Hello, thank you for joining us. I'm here with none other than Kevin McCarty, assembly member of, assembly member of Sacramento. I'm no good with the district.
Well, you numbers. Know what? I'm it's good no I wear my jacket today.
Number right? seven.
Number seven.
Powerful number
right
seven.
There.
Yeah. It's mostly a Capital Insider audience, but there's some folks listening that are, you know, not of this world. You know, when we did our AB5 episode, a bunch of people tuned in from throughout the state. They're like, oh, this is affecting me. Actually, I didn't know. What a wonderful resource. Just to talk to us a little bit about the areas that you represent here in town.
Yeah, so we're, of course, in the capital city of Sacramento. So my district is the majority of the city of Sacramento, and I have the city of West Sacramento, a little bit of the unincorporated county. But it's pretty much the Sacramento seat, which makes it so great. Most of my constituents are very knowledgeable about state government. They always want to talk to me about the issue of the day, AB5 or whatever, when I go to the Little League fields or Trader Joe's or, you know, walking my dog. I always have conversations.
You know, it's one of the interesting things I always said about, like, kind of here in Sacramento is that you have a constituency and you have a community worth of people that kind of give a darn, where it's like, you know, it's probably different than if you're representing a lot of other parts of the state, where it's like a lot of the people here that are your constituents work for the state, work on state programmatic issues, work on civic society type of stuff in a way that might not be true for a lot of other districts. So, you know, you probably get the average constituents probably like a lot more engaged in state government, you know, given the seat that you represent, than a lot of other seats, I would guess.
Yeah, I always joke about that when I talk about running for office. When I went to campaign and knock on doors, and people wouldn't say, you know, are you a Democrat, Republican, what are your issues? They want to know, like, what's my position on line 5 of the recent version of the cap and trade expenditure plan? They're very, very specific, which I like. I'm, you know, kind of
you're a policy guy.
Policy guy and political guy, you know, got to have both hats. Yeah. So I love the engagement of the people in this district.
Yeah. Hey, we talked about this last time when you were on. I called you my brother from another color. You know, making fun of the African American, the African American thing. You know, you're in the black. I think at one point you chaired the African American caucus.
I did not, but certainly, you know, I'm a proud member of the black caucus. And I'm biracial. I love the song, the walk up song there.
Yeah,
David Bowie, because
your English roots.
Yes, and my late mom loved David Bowie.
Yeah,
and he was a good bloke from the UK.
Yeah, dude, you know, it's David Bowie. You know, I think about David Bowie. This is a little bit off topic, but I just think this is relevant. I just think it's cool. Courage comes in all different sizes and shapes and colors. You want to talk about a tough guy? Here's David Bowie dressed up like a popsicle, you know, in the streets of South London before it was cool.
Yeah.
Before it was cool, he's cruising around South London, you know, doing the artistic thing in really rough neighborhoods. Just going to do his thing. You know what I mean? That's real courage, man. I mean, that is no easy feat. And just the life that he lived and just the way with which he carried himself. And he was an artist to the end, man. He was an artist to the end. You know, he did that music video about himself dying at the very end. And that's courage, you know, that's courage.
So, and the song Rebel Rebel. So sometimes in politics, you need to get out there and get on a limb. So that's a good reminder to me as well.
Is that why you chose the song?
It has a great riff to it, but you know, the song is Rebel Rebel.
Yeah, it's like your pump up song. So I understand that you have a playlist of walkout songs.
My walk up songs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So we had like Black Eyed Peas.
Yeah.
And then Seven Nation Army.
Yeah.
And Rebel Rebel.
You have to stay tuned. This is on our upcoming Legislative All-Star Game. I get to pick a new song every year, so I'll let you know.
Very cool. Hey, so it's the top of the legislative session. It's February now. Lots going on, kind of breaking news almost every day. One of the things that happened early in the year was this issue with the vaping, you know, this was a Kevin McCarty bill last year was the vaping issue. And then there was a, what was it called? Vanguard 2020, a number of members got together and said, hey, you know, we stand behind this vaping issue and we want to see something done. And sent a pretty clear, this is what I'm reading. I'm not in the Capitol. You know, this is running the show is like the one thing that I do that's political. Right. But to me, when I saw that, I said, hey, this is a pretty clear marker that we, you know, a plurality of the Democratic caucus intends to get something done on vaping. There was some writing about it that was maybe, in some of our favorite blogs or whatever, that was maybe kind of out there, not accurate or whatever. Do you just kind of want to talk about the vaping issue? Where's the caucus on this? Where are you on this? Yeah. the chair of GO, you know, obviously was not helpful in terms of getting something done last year on vaping, if we can say that. Just your open thoughts. Do you want to respond or set the record straight on any of this?
Yeah, I was focused on the big picture. You know, there's a lot of drama in this business, and I don't want to get chasing down these rabbit holes because who knows where you'll end up.
Yeah.
The big picture is it's an increasingly focused public policy epidemic for people across California, Republicans and Democrats. I mean, Donald Trump's all over this issue. And, you know, we're certainly pleased by this recent FDA action focusing on the flavored e-cigarettes. California still, I think, has an opportunity to step up even stronger than what's been done so far at the federal level. You know, we had a couple bills last year and they ran out of time. The legislative process is messy sometimes, but I'm confident that we're regrouping this year. We restarted the clock and introduced a new bill, and we're all lining up behind one bill in the Senate. So last year, Dr. Wood and this I had is, a bill.
Yeah, Dr. Wood's bill.
We had a joint bill in the Assembly, and then we had another bill in the Senate. So now we're all focused on one bill right now, and that Senator Hill's bill coming up to its first hearing in the next few weeks in the Senate, and I'm confident it's going to come over to the Assembly. And, you know, I've been talking a lot with Chairman Gray and about this, and I think that we'll be able to come to a resolution because it is a bipartisan issue. You saw in the Senate, there's multiple Republican co-authors. Again, the president's speaking large on this issue. So I'm very optimistic.
Mm-hmm. You know, that was one thing that I found, again, just as an outside observer, honestly, I found kind of tough at the end of last year. Was, you know, there was a contingent of folks that wanted to do something on this issue in the building last year, and were just unable to for whatever reason, right? You just couldn't get it out of committee, whatever. But then, you know, Trump, who is nothing if not a populist, he realizes that there's some popular demand for action on this issue, you know, especially the popcorn lung stuff was happening last year, and he just jumped on it through executive order. I was like, man, isn't that something? Like, the Trump is like more progressive and more protective than the Democratic caucus on this. Like, that's not right. That can't, you know? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think that's part of, like, maybe that's part of what happened where it's like, you know, at the top of the session, what was it, like 32 people signed onto a letter, 32 members signed onto a letter saying, hey, enough's enough. We intend to move on. Is that a good way to characterize it?
Or? I don't know the number. I just know we have a strong coalition and I'm ready to turn the page on this issue. And we're going to get at this year. And I'm comfortable that we'll have a good solution in the coming months.
The way it's written in the health and safety code. So presumably the health committee will go first, right? The health committee will go first in the hearings. And that was intentional.
Well, that was our bill in the Assembly last year and the Senate. I'm not sure how Hill has it written. But it will be heard in both the GO and the health committee when it comes to the Assembly. I'm very, very hopeful this year. I think it's changed. The whole dynamic's changed. Look, we have Republican soccer moms throughout California that are hammering on this issue. It's not a red or blue issue. This is, you know, an issue that people think we need to step
it's
up
so,
on.
It's so crazy how these issues evolve. I used to be a fellow for Jerry Hill for like 1 year. I was his assembly fellow. And we had a proposal, you know, we're like looking at legislation back then. And we had a proposal back then where it's like one of the African-American activists in this community wanted to work on banning menthol, you know. And man, this was 10 years ago now. And, you know, it wound up passing on the legislation, but there was always kind of like this group of folks that, you know, from almost like an African-American perspective, like menthol is like really disproportionately hurting our community. But there was kind of not a terrible amount of action on that. Right. But now it's like vaping and it's killing teens and it's kind of like the issue has evolved. Is that fair to say? Like it was previously kind of like, I was just hurting this community and everyone kind of looks the other way. Now vaping's hurting everybody and it picks up more speed.
Well, I think you're raising an issue. You, the same thing could be said about the heroin epidemic and opioids and crack cocaine.
Yeah. It's hurting white people. It's like, we got to do something.
Black issue. That was a problem. That was a shame. And now it's hurting, you know, all communities. It's an epidemic. Let's get at it. So it brings up a good issue, but again, there's a big coalition and a drumbeat on this, and so we will act this year.
Very cool. Hey, what else are you working on?
I got a big list.
Yeah?
Yeah. Well, the stuff I ran for office on, I think it's important to stay at it. You know, I was a big education candidate, public education, when I ran. You know, my platform was we should invest in kids, not in prisons, and I focused on early education and preschool and our K-12 schools and higher ed. So I have, a bunch of proposals on universal access to early education in California. We have a big proposal. The governor has been pushing universal preschool, and, you call it universal preschool or pre-K for all, whatever it is. We're working on a solution to that through the budget and through legislation. So I'll be announcing a big bill on that very, very shortly.
Well, you can announce it. You can announce it right now.
I'm not ready yet. I'm still working on the details.
You know, it's funny. It's like, I'll put the 10-year hat back on, but I mean, this was it's so funny. I think Jerry Brown said something about this too. He's like, a lot of these issues that we deal with are just kind of, it's like the same list of issues over and over and over again, because it's, what's old is new again. Like these, it's just cyclical, right? I mean, the universal pre-K thing, we've been talking about that forever.
Yeah, right? But here's the big issue on this. Speaking of other states, is that California leads in so many issues. We're the leader in civil rights and, climate change and, all these issues, gun violence. But on this one, on universal access,
we're behind.
Pre-K, there are Republican states that are ahead of us. Florida, yeah. Oklahoma, Georgia, they're doing it. And it's kind of embarrassing that California, we're leader in all this, and we're not. And the worst part about it is, if you look at the top issues that we're trying to focus in California on, frankly, I would say some of the top issues, of the top five, three are in these fronts. Poverty,
right?
Too many kids living in poverty, our education achievement gap, and the pipeline to our criminal justice system. And if you ask any economist or researcher, they say, if there's one thing that you could do to address all those issues, it's investing in early education. The Nobel laureate economist Heckman says that this is the top thing that a society should be doing, is focusing on universal quality early education. And, I will say too, early education is not just for kids that are four, it's the birth through five. So child care for infant and toddler programs are critically important too. But at the minimum, we should make sure that all kids have at least 1 year of quality early education before they enter kindergarten. And so you can do that through our public school system, through our TK program, or through our state preschool program. And there's a couple ideas out there, and we're about to coalesce with one in the coming weeks. So I'll be excited to introduce that bill.
Can I just spend a little bit of time on this? I'm not an education guy. I'm a martial arts guy. I run a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu Academy. ESAC BJJ, come check us out. Come strong. Come find a stronger you. But I teach a children's class. I teach children's class two times a week, and I got somebody teaching the third one for me. And we have two little sections of the room. And so we have like a five through seven kind of in one little section, and then we have like 8, 9, and 10-year-olds in the other section. And, you see in some of these early, and then the backstory to some of these kids, right? The parents talk to you, or like, hey, we're fostering this kid. We're hoping we could bring him in. Great, no charge for the foster kid. Just bring him in. We're just glad to have him. We're like, hey, we're the grandparents, but this kid was actually born, with not the opportunities you would love for them to be born with, or like, you just hear the backstories. You just hear the backstories, and you see the levels of engagements in the family, and you see the opportunities and the lack of opportunities that come with that. Some of these kids have better attention spans. Some of these kids, feel better loved, and they feel, more, they've just been settled down in their behavior more because they've been educated better. Even at that young age, you can already start to see it. We're like, the kids who just were never really properly looked after can't sit still for 17 minutes. They can't sit still for seven minutes, And it really, like, for me, it breaks my heart because, I wasn't around a lot. I'm not a lot around a lot of kids in my adult life, like young kids. But you can just see clear as day. You can see clear as day the different levels of engagements and the different levels of access to resources that these kids have.
Yep.
And you can see it clear as day played out in their behavior, in their self-esteem, and what they think of themselves and others. And, and then you see some of these kids, these 10-year-old kids become 12-year-old kids, And then if they're girls, they hit puberty earlier, and then they start getting tracked for really bad behavior at such a young age. Where it's like, man, just because the dad was a dirtbag or whatever, right? It's just, it breaks my heart to see, entire lives kind of put like on the wrong track or not given the same opportunities just for lack of what is at the end of the day, not even a lot of resources.
Yeah. That's why it just breaks my heart. Early learning space is so important. That's the foundation for creating young people, and the negative outcomes later in life, a lot of times can be traced to, what type of programs are available to families and moms when their kids were you know, babies and toddlers, and right up before they enter kindergarten. So, you know, that's one of my top issues.
Can I ask you a question on this real quick? You talked about you're not ready to announce it. I get it. There's moving pieces to this, but one of the words that you used is like, we're pulling a coalition together. You said something like we're pulling people together. This is, you know, we can all agree on the sentiment. Every child needs the highest quality resources and the best education. How you get there, how you weave together the different pieces of a coalition, that's statecraft, right? That's statesmanship. What are the, like, just, can you just talk to us a little bit about the politics, the budget considerations, the different groups in different spaces with perhaps different views on this? Like, what is that crafting that look like?
Yeah, you know,
to the extent that you want to share.
You can demur. Well, I, you know, been in this business for a long time, a few decades, and in this space for many years as well. And stuff can fall apart very, very quickly in the cost space for the Department of Finance and how you're going to pay for it, but also what the programs are going to look like. What does this mean for existing programs? We don't want to harm groups and programs as you build up. Yeah.
Existing programs might feel like there's going to be some competition for lack of a better word.
Yeah, we got to make sure that we kind of, you know, focus on the downsides as well as the upside. So I'll leave it at that for now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I've introduced bills for 5 years in a row on universal access for pre-K. It's not a surprise. And so this is something that I've been doing for many years anyway. And I think we have a version that learns from the lessons from years past and focuses on what the reality is in the budget. And most importantly, we have a governor who's all in on this issue, who campaigned this issue. So we're seeing, you know, what he wants to do through his administration. And we're trying to, you know, put a package together, which we think will be successful in 2020.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very cool. Hey, you know who I ran into yesterday? I don't know if this is a name. I'm not sure if this is a name that you know. You know who I ran into yesterday? The hotel that I live in. I ran in at the lobby getting breakfast. Marla Marshall. She was she's the lobbyist for the San Diego Sheriff. And I was like, Marla, we worked together because I was working for Tony. And I was like, Marla, what are you working on? She's like, you know, this use of force issue is still around. She's like, I thought we closed the book on this last year, but there seems to be people that want to revisit it. Have you heard anything on that?
Yeah, the issue is frankly not over yet. We're trying to implement the law, groundbreaking law we passed last year. So that's an important piece. I don't know about any specific new legislation. Okay. I'm working with issues, frankly, on this issue with the Attorney General's office. One thing that we learned here after the Stephon Clark shooting is that the Attorney General's office worked with our police department to kind of look at the policies that come up with best practices and recommendations for that police department. I think that was a great idea, and the community loved it. So I'm working with the AG on, I'm going to have a bill on that too, which would give him a little bit of resources to go around the state. And if a city wanted to say, hey, AG, can you look at our policies and even this new 392 law about use of force and come up with maybe some recommendations how we could, you know, make things better to keep our community safe and bring about more public trust. And so I think that's something that's really, really smart. So that's not even controversial. It's just a little bit of resources and money. But I'll be working on that.
Okay. What else are you working on? You have a list here.
I have a list. I realize we're running out of time. So, you know, the issues that I've always cared about are criminal justice reform. One issue that I think is important as we've changed our criminal justice laws is we need to reintegrate people from incarceration back to society better. Yeah. And so I have a couple of bills on that. One is restoring voting rights for people that are formerly incarcerated, for parolees.
Yeah.
This became popular last year when I had Kim Kardashian West come out in support of my bill. But also I had Newt Gingrich and the Koch brothers and what's the guy, Grover Norquist. So it was a big coalition on this issue. Yeah. Civil rights groups.
You know, it's interesting, like the libertarian minded folks that are actually teaming up with like the Kim Kardashians and that are like this issue kind of winds up bringing two different ends of the political spectrum together. You know?
Yeah. Cause I think in this, the bottom line is we want to help people reintegrate back into the mainstream. It helps everybody, helps them, and it helps us, keeps us safer.
Yeah.
So I have a bill that I'm doing. We're going to try again, which says if you're on parole and you go to college for a year, let's say you have 5 years parole. Mm-hmm. If you go to college for a year, for every year you go to college, you get a year off of your parole.
Cool.
Like, why would you not want to give somebody in college who's a parolee a break and reduce their parole time? So we call that reintegration credit.
Because then you're dismantling the prison industrial complex, and there's people who don't like that.
Change is hard. Yeah. Change is hard. So I have a couple of those bills. I have, you know, bills I'm working on in gun violence prevention and, you know, common sense gun laws.
You know, it's interesting. I actually got super passionate about this vote, like, you know, felons voting or whatever you want to call it, like the, you know, restoring voting rights to people that are formerly incarcerated. I got super passionate about this because, again, we were looking at a bill proposal in one of the shops that I was working on. And I was like, guys, the numbers on this is staggering. Like, the outcomes associated with people who do vote, who are formerly incarcerated versus people that don't vote. Like, a lot of times when you vote, that's like your one little token, like your one little offering of saying, hey, I give a darn about society. Like, hey, I'm bought into this communal project, you know, as opposed to when you don't vote, you're just not bought in. You don't care about what happens. Like, why would you disenfranchise the very people that you're trying to reintegrate into society? It makes no, you should be giving them two votes. those are the very people that, you know.
So I just want to stop you and just record that and bring you as my witness. So yeah, that's
right.
All I need.
Jabron Maciel, expert testimony right there.
Yeah, no, it's a 2/3 vote. It's hard. You know,
why is it a 2/3? Are you serious?
Because the voters in the 70s locked gets to vote.
No,
so
then you're going
to
get
so all this isn't even a bill. Yeah. It's a measure to go on the ballot.
It's a constitutional amendment?
Constitutional amendment to go on the ballot. But we did have two Republicans vote for it in the Assembly, and it's over in the Senate. And the criminal justice reformers who are pushing this, they say it's 50,000 people on parole. So we have 40 million people. So is this the most important issue for them? They say it is, because they say it's more than one issue. It's more about how we think about people on parole. Are they second class citizens? And we need to, if we're going to release people back into society, we need to understand that it's not just them, people behind them and others, that we want to embrace them to be part of the mainstream. And so that's why it's such an important issue.
No, but there's so many implications to this, a lot of which you're not here to talk about, but I'll just quickly, let me just go down this rabbit hole for one second. There's so many different implications to, like, how long are you going to permanently castigate people for what's in the past? You know, how long are you going to permanently treat people like second-class citizens for what's in the past? I mean, like this Kobe thing, like, that just happened. Like, people want to drag up his past and be like, oh, like, one, he just died in a plane crash with his daughter. But two, you know, I feel like, for whatever reason, African Americans get, like, more stuck to their past than a lot of, like, we just kind of vilify, we just kind of are afraid, we just kind of, you know, like when Michael Vick resurfaced, you know, the quarterback, and he resurfaced as an ESPN analyst, like, people dragged up his past like 10, 12 years after what he did. He paid his dues, you know? Like, there has to be some sort of mechanism in society by which people say, hey, I paid my dues, I'm now ready to re-enter society. And there's got to be an element of forgiveness and an element of moving on, especially with someone who's on parole and who's doing things right, you know?
And even if you have that argument, which is an important one, which I 100% agree with, I think that's the moral argument, just the cost to taxpayers. We spend north of $12 billion in our state budget every year on our state prison system.
Yeah.
We have the largest...
With, like, the worst outcomes.
We have the largest criminal justice system in the world, our country, and California is... you know, super massive as well. And we're starving our UC and CSU programs. And we have tens of thousands of California kids every year that apply to CSU, can't get into a college because not on a space. We have to, same with UC. And so it's larger than just morally right and wrong. There are dollars and cents implications as well.
Yeah. And a lot of Republicans hate it because they hate when more people vote. You know, one thing that happened too was, like, the 16-year-olds voting thing. And, like, a lot of Republicans are acting like, oh, this is outrageous. Like, my political ideology was fully formed by the time I was 16. I was ready to vote. All right, what else you got here?
I was not ready to vote until I was 18.
Are you an 18-only voting guy?
No, I support 16. I actually authored the bill, too. It allows you to now pre-register, which I think is awesome. So if you're 16 and you go get your license or a DMV card, you automatically become pre-registered to vote. So you're in the queue for when you turn 18, which I think is critically important.
Very cool.
So what else am I working on? You know, one of the biggest issues that people, I'm sure, talk to you about and everybody about in California is homelessness.
Oh, it's terrible.
And the
it's
housing affordability crisis. Yeah. It is a stain on California. You're absolutely right. And, you know, one issue that always surfaces is the correlation between homelessness and mental health and addiction.
Yeah.
And certainly not all homeless are mentally ill or addicts and vice versa. But one thing that I think is problematic is too many people are on the streets, have addiction. You know, they commit low-level crimes here and there, and they never get treatment. So some people pin this on Prop 47, that we don't have these things called drug courts anymore because lower-level crimes are not punishable anymore for incarceration. And there, you know, maybe something to some of those issues. But a piece of that, which I'm looking to bring back, is a bill which would, you know, kind of have mandatory drug treatment for people that are in and out of the criminal justice system. Yeah. There should be more of a consequence. In other words, you can say, like, you can keep getting arrested over and over, and we say, hey, after a certain amount of times, we have a choice.
Yeah.
You can either go to rehab or go be locked up.
Yeah.
And so we're looking to bring a bill back that would just do that, which I think would have a significant impact on the underlying issue that we see right outside here, which is homelessness on our streets.
It's just, our current policy is to expose people to the elements until they die. There's nothing compassionate. There's nothing beautiful about it. We're going to look back in history on the level of inhumanity that, you know, the mid to late 2000s brought. And history will not look kindly upon us for this. You're talking about kind of like compulsory care. Like if you keep getting picked up for these offenses, we're going to, almost like Reagan closed down the mental hospitals, right?
Yeah. Not to lock people up for institutional for mental illness, but this is for addiction.
Right.
Yeah. So if you're getting arrested over and over inside of the squad car in the booking halls downtown at our,
we're not just going to let you out. You got to spend, or you have the option to spend 6 months in treatment.
It's a choice. It's a choice. Right now, most of the crimes, the DA does not prosecute because they're low level misdemeanors under $1,000 and property crime. And so they just don't go forward with it. Maybe because right now nothing is happening. Yeah. There's no good happening. The person that goes back to the streets are still, you know, have addiction problems, and criminal elements are surrounding these people in our communities. And it has a huge, huge impact.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this would bring back the drug treatment as far as, not an optional, but hey,
it's compulsory care.
Yeah. A real, real enticement, a real incentive. And there's a disincentive not to say yes to that if you're the individual.
Good. I mean, you know, it's clear as day. You know, we have this guy on the corner of where, you know, you've been to my house, but you maybe saw this guy, maybe didn't, but he just kind of swings. He just kind of swings his arms and his head like this for like 3 days at a time. You know, I mean, that's like a methamphetamine problem. That's like a, you know, who knows, PCP, whatever, but that's a chemical addiction. Right? He needs help. Mm-hmm. It's not beautiful to ignore him. It's not compassionate. It's not liberal. It's not progressive to ignore him. That guy is slowly dying in front of our eyes.
Yeah.
You can't just be like, oh, you know, sorry. You know, like that. And there's so many of them now that, like, I moved here 10 years ago to be a fellow, and I took a little Cato apartment on 15th Street, 15th and O, Duggar Manor, you know, little studio, and living right on 15th Street and that, you know, right by that park, I would see maybe 3 or 4 homeless people a week. You know, now I see 3 or 4 on the way home, you know, but, you know, back 10 years ago, there were so few that I felt like I could individually help people. There are so few. My favorite things, I lived at Uncle Vito's. Like, I love Uncle Vito's pizza. Mm-hmm. So I'd be like, hey, let me get you a slice of pizza. You know, what can we do? Or like, hey, I got an extra pair of shoes here. Take my shoes, please. Don't be barefoot. You know, but now there's so many. It's like, I can't individually help anybody because I'd have to help everybody. That's not tenable. You know, there has to be policy solutions to this. You know, it can't be, there's a point where the mechanisms of personal, like, hey, what can I do for you? That only goes so far. There needs to be policy solutions to this. So thank you. You know, thank you for working on this. Hey,
I got one more.
Yeah.
We got time for one more
issue. Yeah. And then I'll ask you a couple questions.
Okay. I think this is an exciting issue for people that are in Sacramento and frankly, the Bay Area too.
Yeah.
There's so much gridlock and congestion on our roads, and housing is certainly a big issue in the prices in the Bay Area, that we need to better connect Sacramento and the Bay Area. And we have this big debate about high-speed rail and the billions being spent on high-speed rail. I think those monies would be better served by spending it on existing rail lines where people already live. In other words, we have this capital
quarter. Also, high-speed rail is never going to happen.
We have this capital quarter line that goes between Sac and the Bay Area.
Yeah.
Every day, trains go every 40 minutes.
But you have to get off at Richmond.
Here's my proposal.
Okay.
For about $2 billion, we could make it so the trains go every 20 minutes as opposed to every 40 minutes and have the ride now maybe like an hour and 15, hour and 20 minutes as opposed to almost 2 hours.
Yeah.
So you could really, and think what that would mean to Sacramento too. So you could live in the Bay Area. You could work in the Bay Area and live, let's say, in the rail yards. We want to build housing. Mm-hmm. You could go 3 days a week to work from Sacramento to the Bay Area, hour and 20 minute train ride. The trains leave every 20 minutes now as opposed to every 40 minutes. So if we have higher speed rail, not necessarily high speed rail, but a higher speed rail between these two existing population centers, it would just change the whole dynamic, and it would focus on, you know, congestion on the roads, our climate change issues we're trying to address, our air quality. So, you know, some of the most important issues we're trying to tackle today. So I'll be introducing a bill the next week or so, the Capital Corridor 2.0 plan to really bring about, you know, a mini high speed rail to the Cap Quarter line.
Yeah, dude, we got to get that going all the way to the city, all the way to the city. Connected. Why shouldn't they be connected? Why shouldn't it be connected to BART or something like that? You know, it's like, I think right now you have to get off at Richmond and then you take a bus into the city or something like that.
No, you can get off Richmond, take the BART.
And take the BART.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have to change station. I did that one time. You have to change trains.
Yeah. You go to the BART.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you have to change trains.
Yeah.
I did that one time. It wasn't the best. You know, BART is also an increasingly negative experience for people. You know, I mean, they're dealing with a lot of the, you know, addiction and homelessness issues too. Like a lot of people are just like reluctant to take BART because of the, you know, the offenses to their sensibilities, which are increasingly offensive. But
I will say that this Amtrak line, it's the fastest growing line in America.
Oh, wow.
5 years in a row.
It makes all the sense in the
world. People use this. It's working right now. Great. Anyway, you go right any time of the day and look at the Cap Quarter, both directions, mind you. People are going both ways. People live in the Bay Area and work in Sacramento and vice versa. Mm-hmm. And if we had, you know, more cars on each train, the trains go. And that's one thing they say anyway. The writers say, look, right now it only goes every 40 minutes. If it went every 20 minutes, that would be a game changer. And what if we broke the time down from, you know, nearly 2 hours now to, let's say, an hour and 15 minutes,
yeah,
hour
that's
20
a whole
minutes.
Hour difference, yeah.
Absolutely. That would just,
you know, it's funny.
Totally change the dynamic for transportation.
We have a lawyer in this office over here. We have a lawyer in his, I forget what type of stuff he's working on, but, you know, different folks like sublease different offices and stuff. But we got a guy over here in the office next door, and he does some legal work in San Francisco sometimes. And he just came right before you came in, came in with this like red look in his face. He looks like he had low blood pressure. He just looked that way that you look after a 3 hour car ride.
Ask him what he would think about my bill.
He just came in here looking like, oh.
No, most importantly, ask him if he'll come testify at the hearing when my bill is heard, because I know he'll fall in love with his proposal.
He said something, I forget exactly what, I don't want to speak for him. He was like, man, I think I just took a client in San Francisco. I just took a meeting in San Francisco and I'm just, that was, he's like, that commute was not fun, you know? But that's, I mean, that's a real thing, is that kind of that going back and forth. Hey, speaking of San Francisco, I think it was Gavin Newsom just said PG&E no longer exists. Scott Winter's got a bill to absorb PG&E and create a statewide entity. We're SMUD here, but you know, with electrical infrastructure, everything's connected, and it's an issue of statewide concern. You can skip the question.
No, I'll skip it. SMUD is phenomenal. We have public power here in Sacramento.
You like it?
The idea is, can we have public power throughout California? It sounds great. I think there's a lot of issues to work out. You know, first and foremost is, like, if you buy a car, you want to, you know, check under the hood, have the mechanic make sure it's not a lemon. I think that's the same thing with PG&E. If we're buying that whole system, it comes with all of that old antiquated infrastructure in some of the parts of California. That comes with all the liability if there's fires on the road. So it's not just, oh, the public should take it over. Yeah, on itself, I think it's a lot. There's a lot of upsides to it, but you know, we need to figure out
what are we getting
the logistics.
Into?
What are we getting ourselves into? Hey. But I will say that public power here in Sacramento has been phenomenal for 70 years.
I like SMUD.
7 years? No, 70 years. The people in Sacramento, our political leaders, decide, you know what? We don't want a corporate-owned utility. They had the chance to get in the kind of the PG&E, the realm of the day. And they said, you know what? No, we want to build our own. And so it was a wild idea. It was debated for several years. I went back and looked at the history, and the Sacramento City Council and the Board of Supervisors came up with this wild idea to create this Sacramento Municipal Power Plant. And it's been working. Our rates are lower. Our reliability is greater. We have greater outcomes with our climate change elements to our utility. So, you know, big upside.
Very cool. Hey, quickly, SB 50 failed on the Senate floor last week.
Yeah, it'll come back. Yeah, I'm a co-author of that. I've talked to the cities of Sacramento and West Sac. They're not too freaked out that we do a lot of that anyway. But, you know, we need dramatic change to impact housing production, and this relates to the homelessness issue. There's so many people who are just pushed down. The people playing musical chairs who are left with nothing are the poorest among us. And those are the people you see sleeping under the bridges. And so all this relates to the same thing. And, you know, politics is messy sometimes, but I'm confident that leadership and the budget process and this, it'll come back.
It comes back in its same form, more arm twist. It's something of that same
nature. I'm sure it'll come back in some form or in a different form. Okay. But the concept is not going away.
Okay.
And it's an issue that we need to grapple with in California.
Very cool. I think that's about all the time we have. It's been another episode of Sacktown Talks with the powerful Kevin McCarty. Where can folks find you on Twitter?
You asked me that last time, and I
yeah, I don't know. That's just my standard closing. I think it's ASM Kevin McCarty, I think. Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
Very cool.
Just make sure they don't Google or search on Twitter and go to Kevin McCarthy.
Very different.
That's what we talked about last time, because every morning my life on Twitter is all jacked up because people write to me about him.
Yeah. Hey, anything else you'd like to get off your chest before we close out here?
Mm.
No? Very cool. Thanks for coming on.